When I humbly set out 4 years ago to restore some desperate credibility to my sad and crumbling life, I never thought that I, your humble host, Matt Segundo, would make it to 300 shows. I thought for sure that I would be sodomized at gunpoint by tax auditors or forced into the streets by the Motel 6 manager who, rather astonishingly, has permitted me to stay, not handing me the unpaid bill for this unclean motel room. The producers do indeed still exploit me, bribing me with bottles of tequila. I've yet to receive a check, much less under-the-table cash. I've thought of punching out foolish old ladies who don't know how to secure their purses as a guaranteed form of upward mobility, but I often pass out before I can effect such plans. It's a sad life, but I suppose there are sadder lives to lead. Although truthfully, I'd be hard-pressed to think of any life that's sadder. J. Robert Lennon may be honored to be chosen as this show's 300th guest, or perhaps he won't. What I do know is that, like my own services to podcasting culture, Mr. Lennon's services as a novelist have been criminally under-recognized. I say this in all sincerity. It's rare indeed that I get a chance to throw around my own ego. But I read a book of Mr. Lennon's not long ago called Mailman that I could relate to, that rocked my world and that remains very hard to get. And it's all because the publisher were a bunch of cowards and pussies. You see, Mr. Lennon wrote another novel, a novel that remains unpublished in its unabridged form to this very day. Mr. Lennon is one of America's most underrated writers, but you don't value him, and you don't value me. Together, we're all locked into the American social contract that places the greed of Goldman Sachs first and culture last. But maybe, just maybe, there are times such as this one in which the priority changes ever so slightly, and there is, for a brief shining time, some moment of long overdue restitution. That is, until some damn dirty relative flips over the Monopoly board.
Okay, so I am here with J. Robert Lennon, who is most recently the author of Castle and Pieces of the Left Hand. John, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. It's a pleasure to have you
to
finally. To this random location, which has $1. What's the name of this place, by the way?
The Royal Oak.
The Royal Oak has $1 pitchers. So we're plugging you on this radio show. So mini pitchers. Yeah. So there's one thing I wanted to start off with about your prose, which I think... it's one thing I've been wanting to ask you about. You often have your sentences ending with a noun. I noticed this in particular for both of these two books, these two latest ones, but and it's interesting because they're both reportorial in their own particular way. Each of the protagonists has a particular slant, but it occurred to me that actually you have ended a lot of your sentences on nouns, and I wanted to ask you about that. There's another question I had in relation to comma placement. But
I can't wait for that one.
Oh, well, I mean, this gets into the sort of terrain of like, you know, intuitive versus consciousness in terms of this on a sense level. But I wanted to sort of get your thoughts on this and as to how the sentences have emerged over the course of these many books.
You know, I've never thought about what part of speech I was ending sentences with. But now that you have discovered this, I should really think of some pretext for its being that way. I mean, I think I like straightforward prose, deceptively straightforward prose. I like trying to do sophisticated things with a limited vocabulary and declarative sentences. And maybe I just like the feel of nailing it down at the end, you know, with a noun.
Is it a matter of location that this, I suppose, dictates how your characters describe where they are in relation to their environment? Because, I mean, topography has been there from the get-go, I would argue. And so I'm wondering if the sentence structure extends from this concern for topography in place.
Yeah, that's definitely so. I mean, you know, I like to notice the places that I happen to be, and I sort of map them in my head really carefully. And so when I move to a place, and I'm probably done doing that, but when I move to a place, It's, you know, the topography of it becomes a major part of my literary imagination when I'm writing. And I surround myself with stuff, you know. I'm a guy who likes old machines, you know, musical instruments and cameras, and I take things apart and put them back together. And this this notion of objects and places being the territory of a story is, you know, looms pretty heavily in my mind. And that's what's going on in Castle. I mean, the whole thing was inspired essentially by the land in upstate New York, the, you know, places that seem like wilderness but are not, because they've been, you know, the forests have been cut down and grown back 100 times. People have walked over every inch of it 1,000 times.
Sure.
And there's something really appealing about that. Wherever you happen to be, a lot of stuff has happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is interesting also now that you're talking about mechanical objects, because again, what I find in many of your books, and it's certainly, there's one moment in Castle where you describe a pencil, and Eric is very particular about comparing it to a pencil you'll find in the mini golf course and the like. And,
yeah, yeah.
And this reminded me of what I see throughout your books, this concern for everyday objects, objects mm-hmm. that the reader can relate to. How much do you think about something like that? And is it just a more of an intuitive, geeky with regard to mechanical objects, or do you think in terms of like, oh, well, that's a pencil that everybody would know about? Because he's very explicitly, he not only compares it to a mini golf course, but also he compares it to, bowling alley.
Well, you know, if he was miniature golfing, he wouldn't even mention the pencil. I think I'm not consciously thinking, okay, what object can I put in this scene that will give it a certain, give it a certain texture.
Yeah.
I just sort of think, I'm going to put this in there. And it's only later that I think about why I did it and how I might change it to make it work better in the scene. But I think, you know, as an amateur photographer, I'm always taking pictures of stuff that doesn't look like it ought to be where it is. And I like that in literature, too, not just in physical objects, but in people and situations that are off in a way that you can't quite put your finger on. There's something very scary to him about this pencil that he finds in the middle of the woods, and where he doesn't expect to find any evidence of human occupancy.
Yeah. But it's also a kind of symbol of his lost childhood, perhaps this childhood that he could have lived. And I'm going to try my best not to give away the book. It's going to be difficult. But,
that's all right.
But this is interesting, because actually I wanted to talk about the fact that you have a lot of lost parents in your books. Yet again, here's another Lenin book, and voila, you know, parents are gone.
Yeah.
This has been there from the beginning. I mean, what is your deal with parenthood, man?
My parents, I hope my parents aren't lost. They might be lost, you know, coming into Manhattan right now, trying to find Brooklyn. But I grew up in a really stable family, and knock wood, I'm raising one now.
Yeah.
And my family means a lot to me. I spend a lot of time with them, and I think the notion of a family that disappears sort of haunts me. You know, it's very powerful to me, perhaps because I didn't live through it.
Yeah.
And it's often, often when I'm trying to develop a character, the first thing I think of is something that has happened, someone in their family, that someone being missing, a space that they have to fill mentally in order to create themselves.
Yeah, but the light of falling stars, you got the parents gone. You have that also in the Bill Keane-like character The Funnies.
Yeah.
And also, this is interesting because normally with early books in an author's career, you see this concern for loners at the very beginning. I would say that with your books, there have been more loners near the tail end of your books, there's always been some woman there to actually aid the kind of aloof type who's trying to get his act together. But lately, in the last, between Mailman and this one, the Castle, I would say that no, actually, you're becoming more isolated. I'm curious why you think that is.
I don't know. I mean, I think again, it's maybe a fear of mine. You know, fear of isolation. On one hand, you know, you're a writer, you understand what it's like to, you want to be alone. You have to be alone. You want silence, you want isolation. But of course, if you're a writer, you're also all about the outside world. You want to engage it, you want to be around people, you want to talk to people, you want to read what people do and talk to them about it, and, you know, which I'm always doing as a teacher. So there's always this tension between the need to be alone and the need to be part of a community of people. Yeah. And the two are sometimes in direct opposition with each other.
So the very active writing has created this intense loner kind of character the more you've done it? That's what you're saying?
Maybe. I mean, I think it's a tendency in myself that made writing a natural pursuit, and it's only intensified as I've become more serious about doing it well.
Yeah. I mean, I also wanted to ask you also, because you seem to veer between like these really lonely tales and these outright satirical tales. Mm-hmm. I mean, after the whole incident with, you know, where your novel got serialized in Harper's, I'm curious if there's some hesitancy on your part to pursue satire again, and that's why Castle was so dark, or what happened?
I just bouncing
around tonally.
You know, I had written Mailman and Happy Land in sequence, and I was in that sort of antic black comic mode for a while, which I think is kind of my default mode, you know? Yeah. And I like to think that I go away from it every few books. I do something very different. And then whatever I learn there, I sort of bring back into the default mode.
Yeah.
I mean, right now I'm writing a book that has a large cast of characters and has some manic satirical elements to it. And in fact, it's a family book, except it's the opposite of the other family books. It's not that family members are missing, it's that there are too many of them. It's a big ad hoc family that has come together in spite of the unlikelihood of that happening.
Yeah. It's interesting, because I thought you were going to give me the James Ellroy line for this book, but...
Oh?
You know, how he says, it's fun for the whole family, if you're the Manson family, and he does this riff every time he sells a book. But, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, I should also point out that with Eric, there is, nevertheless, a kind of strange absurdism to his need for having things in place. And, in fact, and I'm sorry to just go ahead and throw a whole bunch of things at you at once, but I wanted to actually ask you about the two meals he eats. which are essentially bipolar. You have this heavy, greasy cheeseburger, and then he goes and he eats this vegetarian meal. So it's almost as if his choices are reflective of not being able to fit into the middle of these two antipodean ends. And I'm curious how much this was a part of devising the character, having like specific locative places like this so that he couldn't inhabit the middle ground.
Yeah, well, I think the problem with him is he can't inhabit the world. Yeah. And you know, when I wanted him, I wanted to have a scene twice where he had to go and eat something, and he would take that opportunity to sit and think about things for a few minutes. And it occurs to me, where does this guy eat?
Yeah.
You know, he's so abstract. He's so detached from human life, or this is how he presents himself anyway, that the notion of him eating a cheeseburger is just ridiculous. And it was only later I realized that there's nothing I could have him eat that would seem right, because he's not the kind of person that goes to a restaurant. He's the kind of person that exists in this, you know, this sort of dark, violent abstraction. As a dark, violent abstraction. So, I mean, this isn't an explicitly comic book by any stretch, but I found those scenes to be kind of funny to write. I was like, look at him, he's at the vegan place.
Yeah. Well, there's also this notion, too, of him fixing or finishing the renovations on his house under time. Which is interesting in light of the fact that you do mention a rock in this book.
Yeah.
But of course, a rock has no timetable. So I'm curious again about these points of disparity that go throughout the book. How many of these were designed along these lines in terms of, I mean, and also, there's also the symmetry, of course, of his very predicament. Here he is, something terrible has happened to him, and he in turn has become a person who has done something terrible as well. So I'm curious, at what point during the conception and the writing of this novel were you aware, or did you design such symmetry, and did you keep these points of symmetry keep coming up?
The Iraq thing came first, and it was only after my wife was reading an article in Weird New Jersey, the magazine Weird New Jersey, about a guy who finds a castle in the woods while walking through the woods, did it occur to me that this should be the setting for this book that I had in mind. In fact, she was the one who told me that was the setting for the book I had in mind.
Really?
Yeah, and I when I started thinking about this guy, I was thinking of, I'd been reading a lot of Kazuo Ishiguro, you know, how his narrators are they're liars, really. No, they're not being dishonest, but they're creating a reality for themselves that's appealing to them. They're justifying their actions, or they're justifying the things that are happening around them in a very self-serving way. I want to write a first-person narrative like that. Not unreliable per se, but it's the sound of a guy who has done something wrong, convincing himself that that there is any ambiguity about it. And I realized that if this was the problem I was going to throw into his path, the kind of person he should be is the kind of person who feels he can organize anything. And he essentially, you know, I won't elaborate on his role in the military, but essentially you're right that it was a war without a plan.
Yeah.
And he's a guy who steps up and says, I can organize anything. And so they give him some chaos and they leave him alone. And of course they give him some chaos that is impossible to organize, for which there is no answer.
Yeah. But simultaneously, I would say that Castle presents a dilemma. In fact, one that I was even arguing with my girlfriend about this book. I said, you know, I read this book, and the thing that's interesting is that unlike his other books, which have been these really expansive narratives in which things happen in this freeform pattern, mm-hmm. this book actually takes some chances with this cultural symmetry, in the mm-hmm. sense that there is a kind of planned scenario. Again, I'm trying not to reveal the book, but a planned scenario that encroaches upon Eric, that in turn develops into almost a pattern of learned behavior.
Yeah.
Which leads me to wonder two things. First of all, did you have Milgram in mind for the doctor?
Oh yeah, of course. And any number of behavioral psychologists who are doing work like that.
Sure.
And, you know, I think even the ones who are not disgraced did work that today we would think of as being on the borderline of it being highly unethical.
Yeah.
You know, but they revealed really interesting and important things about human nature. I think. I'm sorry. What was the question, though?
Oh no, I was actually going to offer you another one, but feel free to ramble. Go for it.
No. I think I came to the end of a thought. I'm nailing it down right now.
Yeah.
Bang.
Well, I just wanted to observe that unlike the other books, which have this kind of freeform, expansive narrative, you're dealing here with cultural point A created this, and cultural point B created this.
Yeah.
And therefore, you're almost having your character become more enslaved by what happened historically and culturally during that particular time.
Yeah.
And so this must have been a challenge for you, particularly since you were holding back on the backstory of this character until the last 100 pages of the book.
Yeah.
I'm just curious as to how you managed to wrestle with this dilemma, which seemed to run counter to the other narratives of your many other books, which were this more freeform.
I mean, the book was in large part historically and culturally determined, and that is unusual. I'm almost always just start with a character and take the character where they lead me.
Yeah.
But in this case, there was something I wanted to write about, and I was writing about something political, and it's really hard to do that and not sound stilted, not sound like it's artificially injected into the narrative. In fact, it's what inspired the narrative, but it's hard to make it read that way. So, you know, when I started thinking about Lesha's childhood, and I didn't want it to be reductive, where because certain things happened to him, he became a certain way. However, he grew up in an era when there was another war, and that there was, you know, a very similar social situation surrounding it. And, you know, when the Iraq War started to go wrong, I guess very early it started to go wrong, the first thing that administration officials would say was, this is not like Vietnam. This is nothing like Vietnam. They'd begin to volunteer that before anyone started even accusing them of it. And, you know, that obviously told you that it was like Vietnam, at least in some ways, that there were lessons that could have been learned there that weren't learned. And so I decided to make the Vietnam War and the Iraq War the sort of two linchpins of, two sort of points of Lesha's life that are sort of circling around each other.
Well, this is interesting, though, because did this dictate why you kept the backstory, essentially, you were holding your cards throughout the course of this book, that maybe you did this because if you reveal all, then you start to have the reader more aware of the fact that, oh, well, the character's kind of bouncing around these two historical points.
That wasn't what I was thinking at the time. I mean, that came... holding the cards close to my chest came from what I thought Lesh would try to do, which is to say, he wants to tell this story, and there's a part of him that wants to tell this story. He wants to confess. And what he is confessing involves the Iraq War. But there's another part of him, a more dominant part of him, at least in the beginning of the book, that cannot bring it up. And so when you'll notice that for the first 100, 150 pages, you only get information about his past from other people who mention it to him. Someone, a guy at the hardware store, calls him Soldier. And this is the first you've heard that he was involved in the military in any way. And in fact, Lesh becomes very angry at this guy, saying, "What did you call me?" You know. And it turns out that this guy was also in the military and is actually not being hostile to him. But Lesh is paranoid, and so he takes it as hostility. So I wanted him to be able to introduce this stuff into a narrative, almost fooling himself into allowing it into the narrative. And by the, you know, as he goes deeper into the woods throughout the novel, as he, you know, he falls in a pit at one point, he climbs up on a mountain at one point, and as he goes deeper into this wilderness, his memories start to, it's not that he has an amnesia, it's that he's becoming more willing to revisit these memories.
Well, there's also this, too, and this is where the challenge of the book comes into play, and that is, well, given that he does terrible things later in the book, can we justify that by the terrible things that have happened to him? Because this is an interesting moral dilemma, because should you even consider that? Are these two separate points, or are these intended to be this kind of cohesive structure? Should we look to Eric first and foremost before any other concerns, or should we look at it through this prism of is he exonerated because bad things happened to him or not?
I think morally and ethically speaking, no, he's not exonerated because of what happened to him in the past. But it's his narrative. He's the guy telling it. And I think the reason he wants to tell you about what he did and what happened to him when he was a child is that so he can use it as a pretext for explaining what happened later. And he never explicitly draws that the line between the two. But he wants you to. He wants you to say, well, of course this is what happened because this other thing happened. I think it's self-justifying. You know, he's acting in self-interest telling this narrative.
Yeah. So. Well, there's also the constant whiteness throughout this. You have the white deer.
Yeah.
They'll have the white rock, the white castle. No burgers, but there was a cheeseburger. But
that's true.
But this is interesting because the only colors we really know in this book, aside from some clothes, are really just white, and of course the black expanse, the redacted nature of the documents to the property documents.
And of course, the black redaction looks just like the black locomotive that comes into play.
That's
later
true. That's
in the
true
book,
too. Yeah. But I was also thinking more in terms of rock and redacted as well.
Yeah.
But I'm curious as to, again, I don't think I quite got an answer from you on this, but I am curious about the sort of the two opposite points and how much of this was planned in advance. I mean, I'm very curious about the outline nature.
Almost none. Huh. This, I did not outline this book at all. In fact, I had planned on writing a different book. I wanted to write a book about an Iraq war vet.
Yeah.
And I took notes for that book. And I did that for about 9 months.
Yeah.
And it was time to start writing it, and I just didn't feel like doing it. And it was only when Rian, my wife, said, "Listen to this story," told me about the guy who finds the castle in the woods, I immediately thought, okay, I'll write that novel instead. And I started writing it instantly, without even thinking about where it was going.
How many of your books have been planned? I'm just curious. And none of them?
No. I think this was the least planned. I think the older I get, the less I plan them out. And I'm doing something similar with the current book that I'm writing now. I have a kind of a vague idea of where it's going, but mostly I'm just sort of seeing where it goes.
Yeah.
I gave the academic department that I work in, for our faculty meetings, we occasionally give little mini talks, 5-10 minute talks, so that, because we're in a bunch of people in a lot of different fields, it's a big department, it's to let each other know what we're working on. And so I did a talk, which I essentially read for about 10 minutes from this, what was then an unfinished novel. And it involved, he follows a white deer into the dark woods, and he falls into a pit, and he has a memory. And I had not really thought this through. And then a medievalist in the department came up to me and said, "I love the way you're working with those archetypes, you know? Everyone, you know, in medieval literature, everyone falls in a hole and has a memory." I said, "Really?" You know, I think that given the fact that I hadn't planned it out, you know, that it was not an intellectual process, but a sort of I allowed inspiration to do more work than it usually does in my writing. As a result, I think these archetypes sort of fell into the book. And the end of the first draft was a mess as a result, you know, because I hadn't planned it out. So it was a lot more difficult to revise than some of my other stuff. But this is not the kinds of images and symbols that I usually work with. If I'd thought about it, it might have seemed kind of corny to me. But when I was just kind of doing it without thinking about it, suddenly I liked it.
Yeah. But if you're doing it without thinking about it, the question is at what point does revision get in the way of this free-form approach? Yeah. You know, no, I mean, when do you stop? When do you have to say, look, there's nothing more I can do or I'm going to drain the life out of it?
Yeah. I got to that point several times, actually. And, you know, I would get to that point, and then I gave the book to my agent, or I gave the book to some friends, and they said, oh, no, get rid of this, and put this in. I thought, okay. And then I would go through it again. And then I would come to a point where I couldn't work on it anymore. And then I'd give it to my editor or my agent. And they would say, oh, maybe you should get rid of that. Maybe you should try something like this. And so I kept sort of restarting the process maybe three times. I mean, it was recognizable from the first draft. But I wanted it to have a shape, you know. I don't like to read a book that's utter chaos. And, you know, I'm very skeptical about the power of inspiration. I think it is a very limited value, and it's not trustworthy. Yeah. However, as you were saying, the opposite is also true, that if you work over something and work it over until it's, quote, perfect, unquote, then it begins to seem too planned out. It begins to seem sterile, you know? So, you know, there is no answer to that question. I don't know what that point is or was, and I never know if I've stopped at the right point, if I should have kept going, if I should have stopped four drafts ago. But at some point, you know... At least for me, my mind just seizes up, and I think, okay, I've taken this as far as it can go, and I'm putting it out there now. And that's, you know, and usually I'm pretty satisfied with what I've come up with. But, you know, I always tell my students, one of my lines is, every novel is perfect until you write the first sentence, and then it's destroyed forever, you know? And I think it's kind of a positive thing, you know? The work creates itself as you're writing it. You can have a plan, but it's going to pull you in different directions, and as often as not, those directions are worthwhile, you know?
Well, I'm also curious about whether we will ever see the full version of Happyland anywhere. And also,
I hope so. Yeah.
You hope so? I mean, are there any signs of that ever possibly happening?
Let's see how Castle sells, and maybe I'm hoping to be able to convince Grey Wolf, my current publisher, to put out a paperback. I don't know if it's going to happen or not, though. There's an unabridged Happyland, one that W.W. Norton was planning on publishing before they yanked it. And I cut about a third of it to fit in Harper's with Roger Hodges' help. And I actually like what we did. I mean, I think it's pretty cohesive considering the way it came together. But yeah, I do have a full version, and I would love for it to see the light of day someday.
I'm also curious if you have... I mean, you've bounced around. You were at Riverhead, then you were at Henry Holt, and then you were at Norton, and now you're at Grey Wolf. Do you have a possible plan to get all the books under one house so that you can have your backlist available?
Yes, but, you know, my plans are not important, you know, because I don't own a publishing company.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, I'd like to think that maybe my reputation will reach a critical mass that will make that worth doing for a publisher. I would love for that to happen.
Yeah.
But as it is, I'm sort of restarting my career with these two books from Grey Wolf, and I'm liking doing it this way. I think, you know, I came of age as a literary fiction writer when it was kind of the age of unreasonably large advances, and that, which is not to say I got them, but I think I was paid more than I should have been paid given how much I sell, how many books I sell. And what happens at major publishers is if they give you a decent advance and then the book doesn't do very well, suddenly, you know, they don't pick up the phone anymore. They don't want to talk to you. And when you hand in your next book, you know, your editor likes it because your editor likes you, except that you're, you know, then they give it to marketing and marketing says, oh, we can't sell this. And then you're out on your ass. And, you know, I expected nothing better than that. But I think that... I think that what Grey Wolf is doing is, you know, they're making a new effort to, you know, get hold of some, you know, better known and emerging writers and bulk up their literary fiction list, and they seem to me to be doing a great job. I think they've been awesome with these two books, and you know, I'd like to stick with them.
But
you know.
But you're having you are reflecting your particular trajectory here reflects a problem for any author working today, because you have a situation here where, I mean, okay, you don't want to write the same book twice. The marketing people would love to have you write the same book twice, but you don't want to do that because you've got lots of things to say. If that means bouncing back in time, or if that means bouncing around in perspective, so be it. But, I mean, why do you think that your work, which to me doesn't seem all that crazy, has had so many problems?
I make an effort to be more or less accessible. You know, I'm not trying to write romantic comedies or anything, but I'm not an experimental writer. I don't think. I don't know. I think I just have no. It would just be conjecture on my part. I haven't the slightest idea. I think my first couple of books, Riverhead probably was hoping that, it was the age of Oprah and literary blockbusters, and I think there was a few years where everyone was thinking that the literary blockbuster was not just a thing that would happen once a year, that there would be lots of them, and it didn't turn out that way. With the 2020 vision of hindsight, it's obvious that it couldn't possibly work out that way. But I think, my books didn't sell horribly. It's just they sold like decent literary fiction sells, which is not really the stuff of big profits. So they, each publisher sort of let me go, and I tried somewhere else.
Yeah. So. But the question is, I mean, if you were to have compromised more, this is a what-if situation. Do you think that may have had something to do with how things turned out? That you had to stick to your guns to get things running?
The only time I ever really stuck to my guns was for Happy Land, where, my publisher had suggested drastic changes to me that had nothing to do with how good the book was or wasn't, and had everything to do with their paranoia about being sued. And I said no, and then they dumped the book. But it was not a difficult decision. It would have been just dreary and depressing to do this to a book that it was done. I had gone through 10 drafts. It was finished, you know? So, it's not a matter of, I wouldn't have compromised, but what could I have compromised? Like, I don't know how to write a bestseller. Nobody really does. The people who do, I think they started writing bestsellers because that's just the thing they do. So they keep doing it. You know, all I know how to do is write about the things that interest me, and I certainly hope one of them sells well someday, but, it's not, I don't know what compromises I could make to make my career smoother.
Well, let me phrase it another way. I mean, were you ever the subject of really particular notes from the marketing people because nothing like that?
No, there was
There was no, like, extraordinary changes or anything? I'm just curious because, it just seems like, Pitt's Pick on Lennon Day.
It was never anything like that. It was more like, I'd handed the book that got rejected from a given publisher. They would say something like, "We can't sell this," or this is odd, you know. And then, again, in the context of the history of literary fiction, this is really not that odd, you know. Anything I've written, it just wasn't what they were expecting, I guess, and it wasn't what they wanted to go out there and sell. And so they said, "No, we're not going to go out there and sell it." But no, I've never gotten any pressure from editors like that, except for Happy Land.
Yeah. So accessibility, it seems, is actually a downside here because
who
they were expecting
the
whole thing to be accessible.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. You know, I look at somebody like Stuart Onan, who was a sort of solid lower mid-list writer for book after book after book, but every one of his books is totally different from the others. He's always writing about different things, and I think just persistence and continuing to be good has suddenly found him an audience, and his books are selling really well now. I like to think that if I just stay in the game, I will amass a decent-sized audience. I hope so. I know there's no guarantee of that, but I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing because I like doing it, and
but you and Stuart Onan have both dealt with smaller towns. Do you think that maybe there might just be a resentment towards that kind of book these days in the current publishing atmosphere. That's why Sterling Annan, he's also had problems with, you know, he was at FSG, then he had to find a home back at Penguin. So,
yeah.
You know.
Now, I don't know. I mean, small towns are interesting to me because that's, you know, people are free to become weird.
Yeah.
Of course, they are in the city, too. But look, when I think of New York, I think of it as a series of small towns. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, also to talk about Pieces of the Left Hand, I do want to get some into this.
Yeah,
sure. Were all of these stories written in one sitting? I'm just curious.
In one sitting?
Yeah, I mean, each installment of the 100 that are in
oh,
the
yeah,
book.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in fact, it was... There was the particular reason I wrote that book was that my older son was a toddler at the time, and he would take very short naps. And, you know,
really?
I was on duty, if I was on kid duty when he was taking a nap, I would be like, all right, I've got 40 minutes. What can I do in 40 minutes?
This is how the book came together?
This is how the book started.
Wow.
And I wrote about, you know, a dozen, 20 stories over 20 naps before I realized, hey, you know what? I think I'm writing a book.
Yeah.
So over the next couple of years, I sort of slowly assembled it and rearranged it and, you know, threw out some, added some more.
Yeah.
And the book floated around. My publisher at the time didn't want it. And then I left that publisher. And then I didn't even dare bring it to the next publisher. And then the publisher after that didn't want it. And then finally Granta published it in Britain. And... I couldn't even get my agent at the time to send the thing out in the United States.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I started in with a different agent, and he had Grey Wolf interested in a month, and in fact that was the reason I'm with Grey Wolf is that they were interested in Pieces for the Left Hand, and my agent said, well, guess what, he's got a novel too.
Two for the price of one, I guess. Or two for the price of one and a half, I don't know.
Right.
But actually, I wanted to also ask you, I mean, first of all, I don't know how many of these stories actually started off being the same character. Was that your intention all along
this?
Or just kind of, the character found himself through these little nap stories?
Yeah. It was, you know, I was about a quarter of the way through them before I thought, okay, this is one narrator, and it's not me. It's this guy. And it sort of suddenly struck me that it was a particular guy. Like, I could picture the guy, and I pictured the circumstances in which he was writing them. And so from then on, I was conscious of it being stories being told by this guy. And he's sort of a guy who moves to a rural area near a smallish college town, and he just sort of walks around, you know, archly noticing things. And, you know, it's obviously related to my way of seeing, but it's not quite the same.
Yeah. But also, I'm curious at how many of those stories were actually taken from real life or something else. Because, I mean, if you have 40 minutes to concoct a story, I mean, they couldn't have all been invented. They were invented in some sense, but, I mean, there had to have been some initial galvanizing point to kickstart each little nap time story.
Well, I come from a big anecdotal family, you know, we get together and loudly tell each other entertaining little stories. And so I'd say about half of them, probably, you know, the germ of about half of them is from reality. Stories I'd heard from friends, a friend of mine, the guy I dedicated the book to is a big anecdote guy. And there's a version of him in one of the stories. But, I'd say about half of them were inspired by anecdotes or real-life events, stuff I saw in the paper, things that were going on in Ithaca, where I live.
Yeah. Did you worry about possibly repeating anecdotes or having similar-like anecdotes throughout? I mean, it seems to me that you probably had more than 100 stories before the whole thing came together.
Yeah, and I'd quit writing some halfway through, or I'd sift through. I'd write one that was similar to another, but I realized it was better, so I'd throw out the first one. And, you know, by the end, I don't know how many I actually wrote. Not all that many more, but... there was definitely some reorganization and culling at the end.
I'm also curious, and this goes back to the funnies. There are two instances in the funnies, and it came out up in the castle. I'll tell you specifically what I'm talking about.
Right.
But in the funnies, the studio is this long, thin room. There's also a diner in there that is this long, thin diner. And sure enough, when I read the castle and a certain revelation occurs... once again, we have a long, thin kind of structure.
Well, that's so interesting.
So what of this long, thin kind of...
Well, you see, my parents were chicken farmers, and no, actually... And there actually is a long, thin chicken coop in my unpublished crime novel.
Oh, really? Is that the mystery you were alluding to like a couple years ago?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I think this comes from... No one's ever asked me this before. When I was living... When Rian and I were living in Missoula, we went to graduate school there, and we were still living there when we were finished. I had gotten to know from a bookstore job I had the writer Chris Offit, and he wanted to come out to Missoula. And he and his wife decided they wanted to live there. And so he called me and said, just go get us a house. Go rent us a house. And Rena and I were like, yeah, well, you're not here. We don't know what you want. You know, it's just go, you know, just go find something. And so we found this house. And the he said, make sure it's got a big room I can write in. And the basement was this long, narrow, dank basement filled with like crummy looking built-in bookshelves, and there was like no light, and it was black linoleum floor, you know. And I thought, oh man, I could never write in here. But when I called him and described it to him, he said, this is perfect.
Yeah.
And so when they moved in, I went down there, I went to see him, and he had set up this series of long, chipboard buffet tables down there, completely covered with research materials and papers. He was writing a novel about somebody who joins a militia, and so he was doing all this research about. He's reading lots of survivalist magazines, you know, and sort of libertarian newsletters and so on. He had big piles of this stuff everywhere, and suddenly I saw the appeal. It's like this. It was like this. This dark, evil writing lab, you know? And it made a real impression on me. You know, I write in my pajamas on the sofa with a laptop, but I still have a lot of respect for Chris sort of creating this environment for himself. So I think when I think of a workspace, a sort of mad scientist-y kind of workspace, you know, that's the sort of room that I think of.
Yeah. What's your preferred spelling of Gray?
I actually switched, which is why I wrote that story.
It's like Apple to Mac or something, or PC to Mac.
When my first or second novel was under edit, I had been spelling it G-R-E-Y, and my editor said it's G-R-A-Y, and I had a big fight with her about it, and it was I kept it my way, which was G-R-E-Y, but then I suddenly realized that she'd convinced me later, and now I write it with an A.
Are you still on speaking terms with this editor in any sense, or?
No, but it wasn't because of that.
Okay. Got it. Oh, actually, I wanted to ask you about having words that are close to other words. Like in this, you have Jerrysburg, which is close to Gettysburg.
Oh, yeah.
You also have Loesch, which is close to Loesch. And so I've seen this throughout your books, and I'm curious about these kind of slight literalisms turned into batty character names that you frequently do.
Well, I'm fond of batty character names, but I have to say, almost, not Jerrysburg, but almost every name in Castle has some hilariously symbolic meaning to it. Like all the street names and the character names, and some of them I don't even remember what they were. But I think Lesh, I don't remember what Eric was, but there was a word relating to war or something that sounded like Eric, and then Lesh was supposed to sound like Letha. Actually, the first thing I thought to call him was Letham, but then I thought I can't call him Letham because, you know, Jonathan Letham is already Jonathan Letham, and he's the amnesia guy, so I couldn't do that. But, you know, all the names, you know, all these, he's the woods that he lives on is sort of surrounded by
the streets,
The streets, which have names of mythical characters who are related to the themes that the book is about, and I just found this funny. I think I'd been reading Nabokov at the time. He does that just with abandon, and he's obviously getting the biggest kick out of it.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, why don't I do that for a change? But usually I just name people characters. I usually just name them the first thing that pops into my head.
It seems to me that you can't have a name or any kind of concept in your book that doesn't have a backstory to it, even a street name. That's the sense I'm getting here.
In this one, most of it does have a backstory. Yeah. But most of my other stuff, there's just no backstory other than that's what I thought of. And they're not really realistic names in my in most of my books. They're names that kind of sound funny.
Got it.
You know, intentionally.
Well, John, thanks so much for taking the time out. It was a pleasure chatting.
Yeah, my pleasure.
All right. Said.
The sleepers on the tracks have woken up. It's the end of the line. I guess I'll look his up. It was fun while it lasted, because nothing ever does. Love's lost its meaning. It was wasted on us. In the electrical storm, you were running wild. You had a death wish. You were a child. I came to you barren, a lightning bolt. Came back as a deep sea, I would come back as the salt. It's like your head is stuck in a tightening vice. Your ears are deaf to your friend's advice. Cause you know that your heart will never be full. It doesn't always have to.